From the Department of Surgery at the University of Wisconsin, welcome to The Surgery Set. I'm Jonathan Kohler, an assistant professor in pediatric surgery here in Madison. I'm new here, and with this podcast, I'm exploring the ideas, inventions, and innovations of our department, plus meeting a lot of really interesting people. I'm excited for you to join me. Our guest today is Dr. Jocelyn Burke, a general surgery chief resident who's been at the University of Wisconsin since 2009, and she gave a great grand rounds on complex abdominal wall hernia repair, or putting Humpty back together again. We're going to be talking with her about that today. Well, Jocelyn, thank you so much for your grand rounds and presenting on a really interesting topic that I think is of really broad interest to any surgeon who makes an incision has to worry about. But before we get into that, why don't you just tell me a little bit about yourself and what brought you here? And I know you did some interesting things before and during your residency, so.
Yeah, I'm an Oregonian at heart. I spent time on both coasts. I did my undergraduate work at Pomona College down in east of LA in Claremont. And then I worked for Mass General in Boston in between college and medical school. We were doing some, when gene chips were the new thing. So we were doing DNA core work and actually making gene chips for Mass General system. And then I did my medical school at Dartmouth and Brown. It was a joint program at the time. And spent a year working abroad in the Dominican Republic in between third and fourth year, working in a municipal hospital in Santiago doing HIV/AIDS work.
Wow.
And then arrived in Madison for residency. I guess I needed to foray into the middle of the country, but I've loved my 7 years here. I spent 2 years working in the lab with Dr. Herb Chen, doing both basic science work and clinical work with endocrine diseases.
And tell me more about the theater side of things.
I've sung ever since I can remember, but more seriously since I was a sophomore in high school. I've kept that up ever since. So I was in a cappella groups, a cappella nerd in college, and also in medical school. I've kept singing with groups here, and actually my final concert is Friday. And then I'll leave my group that I've been singing with here. I was going strong into theater right up until my junior year in high school. My parents forbid me from going into it. And so I decided I'd go into medicine instead.
Cool.
It seemed an easy choice.
I was a theater minor. So.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. I think that operating theater is a real thing.
Agreed.
So that's really cool. And you're a softball player?
I am a softball player. I was sidelined by an Achilles tendon rupture this year, unfortunately.
That's awesome that you've been able to find time to do all those things in the middle of being a resident in a busy program. And
it's what keeps me human.
Absolutely. And it's you've done a ton of research. You did a bunch of endocrine research, and now you're planning after residency to go on to MIS fellowship?
I am doing a pediatric surgical critical care fellowship next year down at Northwestern. That's both adult and pediatric critical care, and I plan to board in adult critical care after that. And then I am applying for an MIS fellowship for the following year. Next year, I'll decide whether or not I'm pursuing a pediatric surgery fellowship after that. So I could be in for 4 more years of fellowship after residency.
Well, I recommend pediatric surgery. Let's sort of dig into the topic of your talk, which is complex abdominal wall hernia repair. You call it putting Humpty back together again. And I think we can all appreciate what that entails and means. But can you talk just a little bit about sort of, you get in your talk to some of the details about the impact of hernias and how big a problem it is.
We have a significant number of hernia repairs in the nation. They make up a big bulk of our operations in the year. Unfortunately, our data is a little lacking in the most recent years. But even 10 years ago, they were making up 350,000 cases a year of just ventral hernia repairs, not even their femoral or inguinal hernia repairs. And when you think about the cost, it's cost for the repair. An inpatient stay can cost $15,000 or $16,000 for even a couple days stay. An outpatient surgery is, you know, on the order of $3,500 to $4,000 just for the day in the operating room. And it's not just the cost of the system and the patient from a monetary standpoint, but with any hernia repair, you're reducing their ability to lift. We tell them that we don't want them to lift anything over 10 pounds for at least 2 weeks after surgery, 20 pounds for the next 2 weeks. So we're reducing their ability to do sometimes their job that earns money for themselves and their family, you know, for a month, sometimes even longer in patients with high risk of recurrence. So you're taking away their ability to earn wages and follow their normal lifestyle as well.
I was really struck by the statistic that you quoted, that the average sick leave for someone with a hernia repair, admittedly in Europe, I think where sick days come a little easier, but I mean, it was 30 days mm-hmm. of being out of work.
Because sometimes they can't be put on light duty. So if you can't lift 20 pounds, you can't do your job.
Yeah. One of the things I thought was great about your talk is how you break down, and we'll sort of go through some of the different factors that go into hernias, but
The modifiable risk factors, I think, was a really important point that you made about how we can help our patients avoid having hernias. And maybe you could just sort of go over that a little bit.
Yeah. So modifiable risk factors are those in patients that have a hernia that we're looking to make their one hernia repair be their last hernia repair. So try to reduce their risk of recurrence at the time prior to repair, really. And those are a lot of factors that lead to risk for surgical site infection. Diabetes is one of them. So controlling that by getting hemoglobin A1C under an acceptable level for a diabetic, so under 7. Controlling COPD, coughing can really put a lot of strain on a hernia repair, especially a fresh hernia repair. So making sure that we have a patient's COPD under as best control as possible. Weight reduction. Patients with the BMI over 30 have a much higher risk of recurrence of hernias or developing a hernia in the first place from a midline laparotomy. And so trying to get the weight at least down under a BMI of 40 is both our institutional requirement and recommended by multiple hernia work groups. Some look at even trying to reduce it lower than that prior to repair. And this, of course, we're talking elective repairs. So everything goes out the window if you have an urgent repair for incarceration or strangulation. Also getting any patient off immunosuppression that they can be off. Obviously, transplant patients won't tolerate being off immunosuppression, but patients who are taking it for rheumatologic diseases sometimes can, like arthritis or psoriasis. And so reducing their immunosuppression as best as possible.
Yeah. And you quote the European guidelines for hernia repairs. This was a paper that actually came out with what struck me as some really counterintuitive things about how to repair hernias that have been borne out in the data.
So the European hernia repair, it wasn't really a hernia repair, it's a hernia group, hernia society. That paper was making recommendations for how to avoid a hernia.
Yeah.
So how to repair a midline laparotomy so you never ever develop a hernia in the first place. And so we're so used to doing big sutures, big bites of tissue. We're constantly yelled at as residents to get a bigger bite, get further back, make sure you're getting as much tissue as you can. And both that and the stitch trial would suggest that's not necessarily the best way to close a laparotomy. Using a smaller suture, using smaller bites, so half a centimeter back on the fascia, and then traveling a smaller distance too. So you're using a lot more suture for your length of incision, like a 4-to-1 ratio, as opposed to what we often get is sort of more along the 3-to-1 ratio line, but with bigger bites. Neither trial really talks about why that is, but you could hypothesize that we're causing some ischemia in those big bites that could reduce the ability for that midline to heal as well.
I remember like when I was a resident in my first 2 years, the emphasis was big bites and get way back on the fascia. And then I went out into the lab and then I came just after I sort of thought I was getting okay at closing. And then, you know, came back 3 years later and I went into the OR to like close the laparotomy. I was taking a big bite and the attendings were like, "What are you doing? Like, don't you know that we close this in small bites?" And I felt how quickly things change, how quickly they forget. Because that really does seem to have become pretty much the new standard is, you know, based on the stitch trial and these European guidelines, the small bite.
It should be the new standard.
Yeah.
It isn't always.
Okay.
And so I've still been hollered at this year for taking bigger bites back on fascia. It's okay if you get the muscle, just get a bigger bite. And I think we really need to think about that when we're closing things and doing adequate tension, but not necessarily strangulating the tissue and taking smaller bites.
And remind me again what the measurements are on the bite.
So half a centimeter back on the fascia, so 5 millimeters back on the fascia, and then traveling only 5 millimeters along.
Yeah.
So keeping your sutures much closer together. And again, you're aiming for a length of your suture that's 4 times the length of your incision. And then using 2-0 suture, using a smaller suture. Also anathema to everything that we do and have been taught, especially at the beginning of my residency. But using the smaller suture makes smaller holes in the fascia. And we don't know if that's why, if that contributes or not. But both the European group and the stitch trial recommend a smaller suture.
The other thing about the European trial that really struck me was that it actually recommends not doing midline laparotomies.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It was paramedians actually had the least rate of hernia recurrence. And yeah.
So the relative risk of the midline incision versus a paramedian was almost a little over 3.5. So yeah, I don't think we're going to convert that because I think that the entrance into the abdomen is much easier and cleaner through the midline, but it's in part because you're scarring muscle back together, I think.
Yeah.
But I don't know. That would be my hypothesis.
Yeah, and Jake Greenberg made the comment, you know, at the conclusion of your talk that if you do get a hernia, it's a lot easier to repair it in the midline than it is off the midline.
Absolutely.
Because you haven't violated those muscle planes. But still, I mean, I think it just goes to show we don't really understand anything about anything. So, you know, one thing we do hear a lot is these complex hernia repairs, and we do have this very active group that does these kind of enormous recurrent hernias. So you've had the opportunity to do some pretty crazy stuff. Can you just sort of walk us through what the basic approach to kind of a complex hernia is? Like, when do you think about mesh and what sort of mesh you think about when?
Absolutely. So you want to have imaging. If you're electively approaching a hernia, you want to have imaging so you know where, as best you can, preoperatively plan where all your defects are. We've had some midline hernias that also have bilateral inguinal hernias. And so we want to, sometimes they're direct inguinal hernias, so sort of a blowout of the pelvic floor. We want to repair those at the same time if we can. And so getting that cross-sectional imaging really helps you in the planning process. And so when you're actually in the OR and you're going to start your hernia repair, you have to get into the abdomen first. Actually, a transversus abdominis release paper mentioned trying just to do a preperitoneal repair. But for the vast majority of our complex hernias, we need to get into the actual abdomen to complete the repair we need to complete. So that often involves a lot of lysis of adhesion. You, of course, want to take your time, not make any enterotomies as best you can to try to preserve it as a clean case. Sometimes that's unavoidable. Sometimes you have wound infections. Sometimes you have an ostomy, which automatically upgrades the wound class level. So once you've gotten everything free, you've gotten your abdominal contents down, you divided your adhesions.
And this is something you could be doing either open or laparoscopic, right?
It is. Yeah. It is. Often with the complex ones, we're doing it open. And that gets back to something I mentioned in the talk, which is that if you've got somebody with a gigantic abdominal hernia, their rectus muscles that they're using to sit up, that they're using to do a lot of their daily activities, are way out to the side. So their functional capacity of their abdominal wall is really reduced. It's really difficult to bring your rectus muscles back to midline with a laparoscopic repair. You can close defects. You can close the primary defect laparoscopically, but there's only so much advancement you can do. So if you're thinking about a patient and their lifestyle afterwards and what their function is going to be, I think they're often benefited by an open repair, because with component separations, with your just midline closure, you're actually able to bring their musculature back into a more anatomic and ergonomic position so they can use their abdominal wall better.
Yeah. And then, so you're doing a lot of component separations, sometimes anterior rectus separations, and then sometimes a transversus and the abdominis release. And that sounds like is sort of a little bit better repair or better release?
It has the benefit of not creating these gigantic lipocutaneous, so like essentially sub-Q tissue flaps. To do an anterior component separation, you have to raise these big skin flaps if you're doing it open. There are endoscopic or component separations, and we've done them here. But in a big open repair, if you're trying to get back to do that component separation open, you're creating these huge skin flaps that can necrose, that can cause hematoma, that can divide the blood supply to the skin, and that can be a seroma cavity, and that you don't have with the transversus abdominis release. And you can even do, you can get into the retrorectus space, separate that posterior fascia off the rectus without having to do a component separation sometimes. You'll still get placement in a retrorectus space of your mesh. And, I mean, again, you want your hernia to repair to be the last one you do, but just in case it's not, that still leaves your component separation for fighting another day if you need to.
So do it if you have to.
Right.
But
don't do it.
But try not to burn that bridge routinely, right? Because it really does hurt you down the line if you recur.
Absolutely. Yeah. So a lot of these patients with this wide defect, we're opening that midline, we're taking down all the adhesions. And then the next step is to obviously identify where your defects are. But once you've done that, is to divide that rectus sheath and get into that retrorectus space and sort of separate it off the muscle out to the semilunar line. You do that on both sides. If you're able to close the posterior rectus sheath without undue tension, there's obviously going to be some tension on the abdominal wall, but without undue tension, then you're done. You don't need to do a component separation. You've been able to close your midline.
And then you put in mesh.
Yes.
I mean, if there's one thing I sort of took away from your talk, it's
reinforce
mesh, which in pediatric surgery, we never use it.
Right.
But we are obviously the exception to the rule, because the rule is now prophylactic mesh. Don't just put in mesh if you need it. Put in mesh.
Right. Which I will say I have not done here, but recommendations are, and studies show, that it actually improves the rate of hernia occurrence, so initial hernia occurrence after midline laparotomy.
Yeah.
But then you're going to decide what you're going to choose for your mesh.
Right, exactly. I mean, we're limited because it's a 20-minute podcast, so we can't do the 7-hour conversation about which mesh is the best mesh. And even so, we'll probably get angry emails. Regardless, what's the right mesh?
So I would say if you're in a clean case, you haven't violated any GI tract issue, you didn't have any wound infection, you didn't have a fistula, you've had a completely clean case, you've taken down your adhesions without any enterotomies, use a lightweight synthetic mesh in the retroactive space. So that's our UltraPro here, the polypropylene mesh. It's got a wide weave and it's inexpensive and it reinforces your midline repair. So you close your posterior fascia, you put in your mesh out to the semilunar line on both sides. You can secure it by putting sutures in through your anterior wall and actually your internal external oblique to fix that into place and then close your anterior fascia over it.
So that's the sort of ideal circumstance, right? Clean case, not a super enormous defect, or maybe even an enormous defect.
Yeah. We've done big pieces of, UltraPro before.
But then when you have that stoma, are you get into the bowel or their fistulas, all of the usual nightmare scenarios, then the recommendation is now moving more towards absorbables.
Right.
Not necessarily biologics, but things that absorb. Biosynthetics.
So BioWay is a biosynthetic mesh. That means that it does have synthetic components, but it's a quote-unquote absorbable. It's invaded by the body's own tissue. That process takes about 6 to 7 months for it to happen. It's easy to make the recommendation when you don't have the mesh in your hands. It's a little bit difficult to work with. It's big and thick and kind of feels like weird felt, but it is what's recommended by the COBRA trial. And the recurrence rates in the COBRA trial were lower than in the RIDGE trial, which used stratus mesh, which is the porcine decellularized matrix.
And the principle there behind using the absorbable is that it's less likely to be infected. It's more...
It's less likely to hold on to a wound infection. So it can get infected just as easily as a synthetic mesh. The synthetic meshes encapsulate the bacteria and they don't allow as much ingrowth of vasculature. So neovascularization theoretically occurs in these biologic or biosynthetic meshes. So your body is able to fight the infection in the mesh. And supposedly they absorb completely to a point where you aren't having any mesh left there to harbor bacteria. Whereas a synthetic mesh never absorbs.
Yes. It's not that they don't get infected. It's just that you're able to clear the infection.
Correct.
And presumably also if it recurs, you don't have to be cutting through a lot of plastic that you then have to resect when you get into the bowel on the recurrent hernia repair. And
BioWay creates a lot of scar. So it is difficult to get through, even though it's not necessarily have a mesh left there. But I think it's our best bet for our contaminated cases. And again, in the retrorectus space, you're protecting it from underlying adhesion formation. And you're also, retrorectus as opposed to an overlay, you're protecting it from any anterior wound breakdown. So if there's a cutaneous wound breakdown, like a superficial site infection, there's a much higher chance it's not going to make it all the way down to your mesh.
Yeah, I guess one of the other things I took away from your talk is like retrorectus or nothing.
Or
right?
Best.
Yeah. Do not onlay.
Okay.
Do not go intraperitoneal. Like you really want that retrorectus for your mesh.
And obviously you're not going to do a retrorectus yet. So yet. I didn't get into future cases because it was really difficult to find examples, but robotic surgery is putting a preperitoneal meshes in ventral hernia repairs. Not necessarily retrorectus, but they are getting back into that preperitoneal space like we do in a total extraperitoneal inguinal hernia repair, but getting into that plane and putting mesh in there, it's getting to that same idea of doing a retrorectus mesh. So that's the future of laparoscopic hernia repair.
Awesome. Yeah, I think it's, as we sort of come back to these sort of basic things, right? I mean, it just goes to show that in medicine, as we evolve, enormous new technologies to transplant a face, we still also have to be advancing the ball in thinking about how we take care of the world's oldest problem, which is the hernia that either comes up on its own or that we cause ourselves. And so I think your talk did a great job of giving us sort of a current state of the art, some evidence-based to think about how to proceed in a thoughtful way and taste of what's to come. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And of course, your talk is available online for anybody who wants to go and see the numbers and some cool images as well. So thank you.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of The Surgery Set. In our next episode, Dr. Karen Devaney of the Oregon Health and Science University will join us to discuss her expertise in graduate medical education and her passion in promoting rural general surgery. The Surgery Set is a production of the Department of Surgery at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This episode was produced by Rebecca Wazileski and myself. It was audio engineered by Chris Hansen and edited by Alex Worley. Our theme song is On Wisconsin, arranged and produced by Jamie Schmidt. I encourage you to visit us at surgery.wisc.edu, where you can find links to Grand Rounds, free CME credits, and more.
You can also check out the UW School of Medicine and Public Health Video Library for a wide range of medical education resources at videos.med.wisc.edu. In addition, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. And of course, you can follow us on social media. You can like our Facebook page and also find us on Twitter at Wisc Surgery, as well as me at J.E. Kohler. Please feel free to let us know how we're doing, and especially let us know if there are topics you'd like us to cover. Thanks, and we hope you check back soon.